Show and the Heritage Radio Network. Your host, Ro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains, and share this seat with my colleague, Marla Camp. She's the publisher of Edible Austin. Every Monday, thanks to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, we bring you community-based, locally-oriented stories about the farmers, the growers, the chefs, and the food artisans that create the distinct culinary regions we all enjoy throughout the U.S. and Canada. And every season, we're doing the same in the pages of our Edible Communities publications. Check us out at ediblecommunities.com. So on today's show, we're going to be speaking about two unique twists on familiar concepts. I'm sure most of my listeners have heard about CSAs, community-supported agriculture, when you pay a farmer early in the season and then you get the bounty each week. Well, we're going to speak with Diane Imrey. She's the Director of Nutrition Services for Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and she'll be speaking with us about the unique way that a hospital that's serving over 5,000 to 6,000 meals in their system a week can bring farm to table. And then we're also going to speak with Ivy Manning. She's going to tell us how you can have a vegetarian, a carnivore, a locavore. Everybody can be at your table, and everybody can eat something delicious from her new cookbook called The Adaptable Feast. So let's take a short break, and then we'll be back with Diane, and we'll learn all about how Allen Healthcare. Welcome back to the Edible Community Show. We're on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I'm here with Diane Imrey. Diane is the Director of Nutrition Services for Fletcher Allen Healthcare. They're located in Burlington, Vermont. And Diane, along with her executive chef, Richard Jarvis, and a very talented and committed team of over 150 co-workers, serves 5,000 to 6,000 meals per day at five locations on three different campuses. And one of those locations is the newly opened Harvest Cafe here at Fletcher Allen, and it's set to become the most sustainable healthcare food service in the country. So I'm very excited to speak with Diane, and I think the way we should begin is to say welcome and then find out what is on the menu at the Harvest Cafe today. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks very much for having me. So lunch today at the Harvest Cafe was, and the same for dinner, grilled freebird chicken with fresh basil, roasted seasonal vegetables, and let's see, one of the other options that I would recommend is a spicy South Philly beef sandwich with a local Boyden beef and an orange chipotle sauce.
Sounds fantastic. And then it looks like you also have butternut squash soup this week and some other great things coming up. So how do you do it? You know, how does a hospital say, we are going to serve local, sustainable food? And tell me a little bit about the philosophy behind that, about how nutrition ties into health.
Okay, well, I'll start with the Healthy Food and Healthcare Pledge. We signed the pledge in April 2006, and that was a pledge that was written by Healthcare Without Harm. That's an international organization that has an interest in improving the health of its members' countries. And the Healthy Food and Healthcare Pledge is really designed to improve the health of your patients, your customers, and communities. And so we signed that pledge. We were the second hospital, I believe, in the country to sign that pledge. And we've been working on it ever since.
Which is really impressive. I mean, when you think about so many people to feed and how so much food is available very cheaply from commodity kind of growers. And so how do you begin? Like, where did you begin when you were the second ones to sign on to that?
Well, we had actually made a philosophical commitment to it before we signed the pledge, and our management team is really interested in a few different aspects in particular in the pledge. One was reducing waste, food waste. One was, I myself have a personal interest in reducing antibiotics and hormones in the food supply. And we were also committed to working with local farmers. And so we started with the things that we were most passionate and interested about. And we also picked some of the low-lying fruit. So we also picked some of the ideas that we thought would maybe be a little easier to implement and get started there. So we started with, I think one of the things that is most memorable for me on the first couple of years is we started working with our local farmers, bringing them in January to start talking about and planning for what would we buy from them the next summer. So that's kind of one of the places that we started.
Which is very much like the CSA idea,
yep.
Where they sort of get money and commitment up front. And what are some of the things you found it's easiest to do that with? So for folks who are listening who may want to go into their organizations, what type of things, at least in Vermont, were most available?
Well, certainly apples are easy. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when we think about apples, we used to buy local apples for maybe a month or two, really during harvest season. And that was years ago, and in recent years, we buy local apples all the way until June now because we have a great farmer that has a wonderful storage facility, and the apples are actually better quality from Vermont local than what you can get on the commercial market. Some of the ways that we approached finding the farmers were we would simply go to the farmer's market and say, okay, you've got great quality, whatever product it was. It might be squash. That's how we found our squash farmer. It might be lettuce. And then work with those farmers directly to see could they actually produce our volume, which is, I just wanted to mention, it's actually about 5,000 meals a day.
5,000 meals a day.
So it's a little bit about 1.3, 1.4 million meals a year.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And so just to give us some idea, how many apples is that? How many pounds of apples? Do you have any idea?
That I don't know.
No.
I bet Bill Sherwood,
yeah.
Our local orchardist, but
from Champlain Orchards,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you've really changed the lives of some of these farmers by being able to do that for them.
Well, that's part of the pledge is really to develop that local food supply. And so we are big enough, we're very fortunate to be big enough as a customer to actually influence the practices of our farmers, hopefully in a positive way. And our hope is that we can help build the infrastructure so that other customers, restaurants, hospitals in the area can take advantage of that infrastructure as well. So.
And what do you think has been one of the most, where have you seen a great impact that sort of surprised you? You know, who's someone that you maybe approached and thought, could they do it, and they've been able to really?
Well, one of our most recent farmer relationships is with Pitchfork Farm down in the Intervale, which is not far away. We could walk down there if we wanted. They had great greens, great quality greens, but a very relatively small farm. I think they're less than 7-6 acres, something like that. So we went down and we did a farm visit and struck up a relationship. Richard's been working directly with them. And I think it was only for a short period of time that they were able to supply us greens, but we were able to ask them to triple wash them for us. Mm. And so we actually helped them develop a teeny change in their process to enable us to be able to buy from them. And so our hope is that we can develop that relationship to buy for a longer season next year.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask, do you have specifications that you give to your farmers for how things need to be grown?
We do. We're somewhat flexible compared to sort of the commercial line of purchasing. We can be a little bit flexible depending on the product, but we certainly have high quality standards and high food safety standards, and we also require insurance. So, you know, we cover the basics, but we also are committed to helping the farmers learn about our specifications so that if they can change what they're growing or their delivery method, packaging method, to help enable them to sell to us.
Well, you had said earlier on you were very concerned about pesticides, hormones. So one of the specifications is that they cannot use those things, or how does that work?
Not necessarily. There's lots of farmers in Vermont that grow organically but are not necessarily certified. Organic isn't our first specification. It's usually food safety and quality.
Mm-hmm.
Organic we consider as a great add-on, and we buy it when we can. So what we do is we go to the farm and we ask questions of the farmer about what do they use for pesticides, why, how do they use it, how are they doing hand washing, those kinds of things. In terms of antibiotics and hormones, when you get into the meat supply, we are definitely a little bit more specific. We ask about why they use antibiotics. Do they use it non-therapeutically? Do they use any hormones in there? That's primarily in the dairy industry. Mm-hmm. We're a little bit more specific about those rather than the organic certification.
And for folks who are listening, I realize that there's been a lot written about this, but since we have you with your expertise here to talk to us today, what is it that the big concern is around the hormones in the milk and in dairy?
Yes.
Why is that such a problem?
Well, I think, you know, the science is a little bit unsettled still, I would say, but there's mounting evidence that points to risk when you introduce hormones into the food supply. And really, my philosophy is there's no need for it, so why would we take a risk that has not yet been measured?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, when you're in healthcare, you think about do no harm.
Right.
And so the idea of introducing it in the first place, I think, was maybe not the best decision. But in terms of hormones, when you measure hormones in humans, it's almost unmeasurable the amount of hormone that makes a difference and can alter your body. So I think that when we introduce hormones into the animal supply,
mm-hmm.
we can't really measure what the impact is. So I guess I would say do no harm first.
And avoid it.
And avoid
whenever
it.
Whenever you can.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the meats, you know, there's a lot about grass-fed. Mm-hmm. And it's a little different story, grass-fed, grain-finished and all that, because
mm-hmm.
I think that speaks a little to flavor,
yes.
not just to sustainability or humane
mm-hmm.
practices.
Mm-hmm.
But what are some of the things you look for when you're looking at the meat supply?
I think our my most sort of passionate interest is around antibiotics, and that's because in the healthcare realm, you see more and more patients coming in with multiple resistant antibiotic issues. And so we no longer have the antibiotics that we used to have to treat those patients.
Mm.
They have poorer outcomes when they're here. It's much more costly to treat a patient that has antibiotic resistance. And so I think that we have to acknowledge that using antibiotics rampantly in our food supply must have some negative effect on our own personal health. So that's what I'm most interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I always ask growers and producers, why and when do you use antibiotics?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that many of the listeners probably don't know that antibiotics are often used non-therapeutically, and that means they're given to animals either through their food supply or administered in some way before the animals get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so a normal use of antibiotics would be use it when the animal's sick, take them out of the food supply until they're healed,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, introduce them back. So I think it's two different, very different ways of thinking about antibiotic use.
So that's one that's high on your list.
Definitely.
And what about the sort of desserty sweet part of the menu
mm-hmm.
in terms of health? Because I know that I've had some of the best desserts I've ever eaten here at the hospital. People
yes.
might find that surprising.
Our pumpkin, it's not a pumpkin, it's a pumpkin custard is one that's very, very popular on the menu.
Well, and the apple cake.
The
I think we actually ran
delicious.
That recipe in Edible Green Mountain,
right.
and it was really popular.
That's
but
right.
I'd love to hear a little bit about your approach to a menu, what you're sort of thinking about.
Yep.
When you do all that.
Yeah, long ago, the management team in nutrition decided that we were going to follow, after much, much discussion, we finally agreed, I guess I should say, that we were going to follow the Mediterranean pyramid as a philosophy for general nutrition. It doesn't mean that we follow that specifically for, you know, illness-based counseling, but
mm-hmm.
for general nutrition, we all agree that the Mediterranean pyramid is good, sound, basic nutrition. It's plant-based, primarily plant-based, less protein from animal sources and smaller portions when you do consume that. And, of course, sweets are at the top of the pyramid, which means the point of the pyramid, or close to it, at least on its way up towards the top, and that just means use in moderation. So we, I think, have a firm belief that sweets are part of a good meal, and everything in moderation.
Well, and we've been talking about, in my mind, have been thinking a lot about your Harvest Cafe. That's a wonderful new restaurant, for lack of a different term, right,
mm-hmm.
that you've opened. It is really a restaurant that you've opened here at the hospital. But another thing that I think our listeners would find surprising is that when you are a patient here at Fletcher mm-hmm. Allen, you no longer are forced to have a tray arrive at your room at a certain time and eat whatever's on it. And that's an enormous innovation, I think, essentially, mm-hmm. to have room service in this setting. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can share a little bit with us about that and mm-hmm. how you integrate these principles into that as well.
Yep, sure. So when patients arrive here, as soon as we get a doctor's order for their diet, we greet the patient, we interview them to make sure that they can actually participate in room service. So can they pick up the phone or can they verbalize their menu choices in some way, or can a family member? And if they're able to do that, we give them a menu that looks very much like a hotel menu. It's got appetizers, chef's favorite recommendations, dessert, of course, entree salads, and then we wait for them to call. So they call the room service central when they're ready to eat. They place their order. The order prints out in the kitchen, and then they start cooking. So it's really fresh, made-to-order food, and it makes all the difference in terms of quality. So a couple of my favorites, and I know some patient favorites, are, the oven-poached salmon grilled with balsamic mustard is actually a new one coming up in a couple of weeks, but our original favorite is with pesto. We've got a pecan-crusted trout, a seafood risotto, lots to choose from, a chicken Caesar salad. There's lots of choices for patients.
And how did that evolve? Like, how did it evolve for you to be able to get from the way it was traditionally mm-hmm. done to begin offering a room service type menu?
Well, we were certainly not the first in the country to do this. There was a few trend-setting hospitals, the first in Seattle, and we visited a couple of those hospitals to see how they do it and decided that as a team we had the management skills to pull it off. And we developed the menu, we trained the staff, we purchased a computer system that supports it, did a renovation in the kitchen to support new equipment, and then implemented it. And I have to say it's really a credit to the management team that was able to do that. We did not hire a consultant, did it on our own. Many places use a consulting company. Educated the nursing staff on how it would work because they're our main support on the patient floors, and then introduced it. Successful.
Well, and I was going to say, what kind of feedback do you get? And how does this really affect patient care? Mm-hmm. Where does food fit into that?
Well, I
whole
think,
thing?
You know, the food, of course, hospitals have a bad reputation for food, and maybe well-deserved in some cases, I think not. But I think that the nutrition component of healthy food is so important because it's the it's prevention at its base. And then, when a patient is here, they have to eat well to heal. Otherwise, they won't heal. So it's really integral to their care. So I think that when you put time and effort and passion into the menu and the food service, it shows to a patient and a family, the family members as well, and it certainly helps them heal. You can't do it without it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found it interesting when you explained to me during one of my tours here mm-hmm. that if somebody calls up and says, you know, I just would like to have the four desserts on the menu today, mm-hmm. or that your call center is the folks are trained to know how to counsel
Absolutely.
Someone with different dietary needs.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about that, how that works.
And yeah. How that works is the whole system is automated with very few exceptions, and so we know what the allergies are for a patient. If they have food allergies, we know what their diet order is. And so, for instance, if they're needing to do carb counting, if they're getting insulin for diabetes, or if they're maybe have severe food allergies and they try to order something that's not permitted on their menu, the call center operator will get an alert and say, oh, I'm sorry, but I can't offer you that for whatever reason, and they know what they can counsel on what the reason is, and then they do a little bargaining and see if they can educate the patient enough to make a better choice, and often that's what the result is. But for patients that don't have any strict dietary issues, if a patient feels like eating 2, 3, 4 times a day, they can call as many times as they want. Generally, we want patients to eat while they're here. You mm-hmm. know, we're not too worried about calorie restriction mm-hmm. with exceptions. But if they feel well enough to eat, we should be feeding them.
That's amazing. Well, now, there's a lot more, too, that you're doing other than just the food they're eating. I mean, the gardens that you have and some mm-hmm. of the other things. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the expanded things going on.
I think my favorite that I have to mention first is that this was our first summer of being beekeepers. And so one of our staff decided that he wanted to get interested. He was very interested in beekeeping. And the gentleman that he was learning from wanted to have bees on site, had agreed to do that, and then it sort of fell apart at the last minute. And so our staff member, Tom, decided that he could be the beekeeper. So we have two hives on site, and they're right outside, right next to the Fanny Allen Gardens, where they harvested their first harvest this summer for patient feeding. We're developing a rooftop garden for next year on a new building that's just being opened, where we'll have grapes, blueberries, all kinds of different fruits, and then the regular harvest of vegetables. And we'll have the ability to educate patients in that area with some sort of a self-guided walking tour.
So patients can actually go out into these garden areas mm-hmm. to get a little bit of a healing connection with nature.
Absolutely.
But then this food is also going to be used in the meals that they're
and we'll
eating.
Have, on the rooftop garden, we hope to have some cooking demonstrations to be able to really teach people who may have never learned how to cook with certain kinds of vegetables or fruit, how to do it, to be able to impact their health at home as well.
And then there's also the herbs that you've been growing.
That's right, in the healing garden.
In the healing garden.
Yeah.
And explain the proximity of there's the client service that goes on there. Is it the phlebotomy or what is that? I don't know.
Outside the oncology
center. Oncology center, right.
Yeah, and so patients in the oncology area can look out into the healing garden or can go out if they're well enough, but often they're in one place for 4 to 6 hours at a time. So they can look out into the healing garden, and then on the other entrance of the healing garden, we're right around the corner from the main kitchen where they do production for patients and the retail areas. And so we have a large herb section there and a huge section for tomatoes, which we've harvested for a few years. And one thing that I think it's important to mention is the philosophy has really taken root at the staff level. And this year, one of our staff, Dixie, just put up her hand and said, I'd like to run the healing garden this year, so I didn't have to do it this year.
Wow.
So, yep. It's very...
Well, and you mentioned the staff. Let's talk a little bit about people and motivating people, how you found them respond to this. None of this could happen without leadership of a great team, and I think mm-hmm. that's certainly credit to you, to Chef Jarmus, who you mm-hmm. work with, and mm-hmm. the people above.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me a little bit about sort of what you've seen happen with your own group of people that work here and their mm-hmm. attitudes.
I think the more you become educated around sustainable food, the more interesting it becomes. It's kind of like you light a little fire and see where it goes. And we've taken the philosophy here of if someone's interested in something, try and feed it, pardon the pun, and see where it goes or where it grows, really. So we try and encourage the staff level, if they have a particular interest in something, to try and give them a little time to develop that. So some have made farmer connections directly. Some at the Fanny Allen Garden got out there and tilled the ground themselves.
Mm.
And so we try and encourage that. And keep in mind that the staff that we feed here, not just our nutrition staff, but the staff that we feed every day, thousands of them, also have farmer connections because it's such a local, small community that when we put Boyden Farm, for instance, our beef supplier, when we put them on a menu, people live near that farm and they
mm-hmm.
recognize it and maybe have relatives there. So it's really a connection to the land and to the community.
And so what would you say, because we are fortunate, you're located
mm-hmm.
in Vermont, where it is a small community,
mm-hmm.
but somebody's listening. You said Seattle took the lead
mm-hmm.
on some of these things. What would you say to a larger urban population that might want to get something like this started? What's a good place to start?
Well, I think we had great success this past year or 2 years ago, actually. We started a CSA program, a community-supported agriculture or a farm share program delivered at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that many of the larger cities are able to do that now. It seems to be a growing phenomenon. And so if you want to get your employees interested in local farm-based food, bring it to them at work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's a great place to start. And every community has farms in some way that are local to them. So it might be, for us, it's 5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
For a larger city, it might be 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would say start in the vicinity. Learn at the farmers markets what's available, or at the local co-ops. It's also a great place to start. And just see what's being actually produced in your region.
And what's next? I mean, what new innovations are you thinking
of?
Well,
we were very fortunate to receive a federal grant that's administered through the CDC. It was sponsored by our senators and our congressmen, and it's for the development of the Center for Nutrition and Sustainable Food Systems. And we are developing a leadership team across the state and with bordering states to help educate food service folks in healthcare on sustainable food issues and try
Fantastic.
And promote the idea of local purchasing. So that's next. And then, of course, the rooftop garden will be an initiative for next spring.
So that should be open in 2010,
yeah.
You think?
Definitely.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, and before we close, I want to mention that you may see Diane Imrie's name on a book called Cooking Close to Home. She and Chef Richard Jarmus are authors of a wonderful book that really takes all of these principles and speaks about them, and it just shows how it's a real 360 commitment for both of them in both their personal and professional lives. So Diane's going to stay with me as we speak to my next guest, Ivy Manning, who's written The Adaptable Feast. Let's just take a short break. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great. Thanks so much.
When I first met you, baby, you fed me on chicken and wine. With steak and potatoes and lobster, baby, I sure felt fine. Now all you feed me is seaweed and alfalfa sprouts and sunflower seeds, and I've got my doubts, 'cause babe, you left me here with a chicken coat on blues. I'm sitting here thinking, but all I got is food for thought. I'm sitting here thinking about the 20 pounds of groceries we bought. We bought 10 pounds of brown rice and 5 more beans, 5 pounds of granola, and you know what that means.
Hi, and welcome back to the Edible Community Show. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. I'm here with my guest, Ivy Manning. Several years ago, Ivy fell in love, and that prompted an entirely new way of approaching food for this accomplished chef, cookbook author, and committed carnivore. Love almost conquered all, in a sense, and Ivy was motivated to find ways to create meals that included the flavors and ingredients she loved, while still respecting the vegetarian eating style of her new husband. So the result is a wonderful new book. It answers that dilemma of how to prepare meals for a guest list that includes vegetarians and vegans and meat eaters, and she's calling it The Adaptable Feast, and it really is a terrific book. I've enjoyed looking through it and cooking from it. Welcome, Ivy. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So you are based in wonderful, beautiful Portland, Oregon, where you have access to all sorts of delicious local food all year long, right?
That's right.
Which makes it a little easier than for us folks here in the hinterlands of the north. But I wanted to ask you, sort of, what was your guiding philosophy that sort of, you know, led you through all this? Tell us a little bit more about how this evolved for you.
Well, they say write the book that you need. And I started dating Gregor Torrence, who's now my husband. And when I first introduced him to friends, they were like, oh, this is never going to work. He's too skinny. And he only, he's a vegetarian. And he'll either switch, he'll get one bite of your pork spare ribs and it's, and he'll switch over, or you guys aren't going to last. It's just too hard, because food is such a huge part of my life, and all sorts of food, not just vegetarian. So I needed this book. And when I first started dating him, I tried to go vegetarian. I had been vegetarian when I was a teenager, and I thought maybe I could go back to it. But I was teaching cooking classes and recipe developing, and you know, I had meat in the house, and I had to for my job. So I started making just a few recipes, really simple things, like I was craving carbonara one night, and I made myself carbonara. I said, well, I'm not going to make him a whole separate dish or just make him tofu pups again. Make him something. So what I did was make the recipe with fresh vegetables instead of bacon, and then I added bacon to my portion at the end. And I thought, well, I'm onto something here, and I kept tinkering with other recipes in the same way, where I would add meat at the end or make it all vegetarian to a point, and then there'd be a fork in the road, and both of us could eat from it.
And so, what sort of guides your style of cooking, would you say? You know, there's different folks with different styles. What would you say is the Ivy Manning approach?
I think comfort food from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
If I could learn...
Okay.
A few classic
dishes. And then one thing I noticed in the book is your approach to flavors, and I'd love for you to elaborate on that for us a little bit.
Well, when you're cooking vegetarian, or you're transferring a recipe that normally has meat in it and making it for a vegetarian, there can be sort of a lack of umami, which is the fifth sense taste that you have. You know, it's hot, salty, sour, sweet, and then there's umami, which is sort of meatiness. The Japanese have a word for it. We don't yet, but it's sort of the kind of thing that mushrooms or Parmesan cheese or ripe, rich tomatoes, what they add to a dish, that sort of savory quality. So when I'm cooking, when I'm converting the recipe for vegetarian for, say, something like shepherd's pie, I'll often add mushrooms or, for instance, with the bolognese sauce, instead of meat for the vegetarian, I add porcini mushroom dust. And it gives the sauce a richness and an umami quality without adding meat.
And I noticed in your book you even have an umami, sort of a glutamate chart that mm-hmm. shows people that Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, for example, is one of the highest, right, along with soy sauce. And then, mm-hmm. and you sort of guide them. So I guess one thing you might be able to say is that if you're looking to take meat out, maybe try to put one of these things in. Is that kind of?
Yeah, exactly. It certainly helps to make the dish more satisfying. And if you're interested, you want to test the vegetarian waters. These are great recipes. The Adaptable Feast is full of recipes that are both vegan and vegetarian and omnivore, but if you wanted to try it out and see, well, what would this dish be like without meat? Adding umami flavor makes you not miss the meat. You really wouldn't necessarily notice that it didn't have meat in it. In fact, some of the recipes while I was developing, I found that I liked them better with the vegetarian version better.
And what would an example of one of those be?
I fell in love with seitan, which is wheat, high glutamate wheat protein. You can make it at home or you can buy it in the store. It's where you'll find tofu and things like that. And there's recipes like a stir fry, and I did it with peppers and, you know, thinly sliced beef for me, and then I made it with seitan for my husband, and I was really surprised to find that I actually preferred the seitan version. It's got sort of, it's got the same meaty texture, but the flavor was a little bit different. I found it easier to digest, and I just liked it better. I felt lighter after eating it.
And are you finding you eat more vegetarian meals now that you've developed?
I'm more open-minded about it, certainly, yeah.
And that you live with a vegetarian. And there's health reasons, too, and you comment a little bit in your book on the nutrition components about that, you know, of a mixed diet kitchen and the concern people have. Can you share with us a little bit about that concern, about getting enough protein if you're not eating a lot of meat?
Well, it's very frightening, especially if you're a parent and you've got a child that's come home and decided that they're a vegetarian and you really are worried about the protein. And if you've never lived a vegetarian lifestyle, you might think that the only way you can get protein is through meat, and that's certainly not true. So in the beginning of Adaptable Feast, I write a little bit about, you know, what really is enough protein. And I think a lot of people would be surprised that with a varied diet, you really don't need as much as an 8-ounce steak on your plate every night. That's not the case. There's lots of other ways to get protein into your diet, and you don't need quite as much as Americans that eat a lot of meat, you know, think that you do. You really don't need that much.
Well, and so actually, I think, you know, my earlier guest was Diane Imrie, and she was talking about how at Fletcher Allen Healthcare, the hospital based in Burlington, Vermont, they've actually followed a Mediterranean pyramid, which mm-hmm. is a lot more of what you're talking about, you know, portions of meat that are really just sort of adding a little to the rest of the vegetables that are on the plate.
Right.
What are some of the recipes you'd suggest for people who want to, you know, that are a little less daunting? You know, what are some good places to start with this?
Well, I know
I loved your shepherd's pie. I thought that was a really great option.
Well, thank you.
And maybe you could
tell the listeners a little bit
about how you designed that.
Well, the shepherd's pie is, I'm half Irish, and my dad owns a pub, so I'm pretty familiar with shepherd's pie, and I certainly wasn't ever going to give it up, and I love it with lamb, but for my husband, I use soy crumbles, which you can buy at any health food store, grocery stores are starting to carry it now, and it's really quite simple. It's the same sort of mushroom-based gravy with a mushroom broth that you can buy. Pacific brand makes a great mushroom broth. And that gives you that sort of dark, meaty flavor. And then I add crumbled lamb at the very end to the gravy for me and top it with mashed potatoes. And for him, it's just soy crumbles. It's really quite simple.
You mentioned your dad owned a pub. Did you grow up working in the pub? No,
it's been a retirement toy. It's something he took on after he retired.
So how did you get your interest in cooking?
My great-grandfather was a chef. My grandmother was a great cook. I don't know. And my mother was a horrible cook, so I think out of survival, I started to figure out how to cook a little bit and had found some cookbooks that my mom had stashed underneath the basement steps because she had no interest in them and started cooking at a really young age. I started when I was about 12, 13, I think, was my first Thanksgiving.
And you cooked the whole Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. What was on the menu for that one? Can you remember when you were 12 or 13?
I'm sure. Well, I did a turkey, but, you know, I'm sure it was terribly dry. But, you know, I used to read Gourmet magazine kind of obsessively. I would read the whole thing. So I learned a lot from that. And I'm sure it was, you know, boxed stovetop stuffing. It was, you know, mid-80s. I'm sure it wasn't great. But for a 13-year-old, you know, I can make a decent gravy. At least mine didn't have lumps in it. My mom's was pretty lumpy.
Well, and the reason I asked you about that is, you know, certainly it's evolved. And, you know, you mentioned Thanksgiving, and that's coming up. So what would be on your Thanksgiving table now?
Actually, I'm going to do a guest blog post for thekitchen.com, which is connected to apartment therapy. And I worked out a beautiful homemade cornbread dressing with apples in it, so it's a little bit sweet, and it's got fresh herbs. And then I stuff it inside of delicata squash for the vegetarian, and those are fun because you can eat them with fork and knife. And the peel is thin enough that you can eat the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And delicata squash, if your listeners aren't familiar, is they're small. They're like maybe 8 ounces at the largest. And you can have them, and they turn into little boats that can hold stuffing. And you can bake those at the exact same time as a turkey breast that's stuffed with the same stuffing. So everybody gets the same stuffing, but you're not serving your vegetarian guests just you know, the starchy side dishes. They actually get something that's quite lovely on their own.
So you don't do that tofurkey that some folks do, right? Isn't there a
not
turkey
really
you can actually
the
buy?
Fake meat
it's tofu shaped into a turkey or something?
Yeah, it's pretty wretched. I tried it 1 year and I was like, well, listen, I'm a trained professional. I can certainly do better than this.
My
husband had no interest in it either.
And what else will be at your holiday table?
What's that?
What else will be at your holiday table? You'll be serving?
Well, for my first book, I have a lovely cranberry chutney that's a little bit spicy. It has fresh ginger in it and serrano chilies. I really love that. It's just a little different, and with such a rich meal, the heat of the ginger and the chilies cuts through, you know, some of the richer dishes on the plate. So it's a true Indian-style chutney, but it just happens to have cranberries in it. And I always do celery root mashed potatoes. which is another recipe from the Farm to Table cookbook, my first cookbook.
Yes, and I'm glad you're mentioning that because I did want to mention your first book. So we should let our listeners know that you have another book called the Farm to Table cookbook and that that's available as well in addition to the Adaptable Feast. But I interrupted you. Tell me more about the celery root mashed potatoes.
Oh, well, celery root is sort of it's an odd-looking vegetable. It's starting to catch on here. You can get it at farmers markets and good greengrocers. And it looks like a softball that has sort of a miniature head of celery on the top. And when you cut away the sort of gnarled roots on it, and cut into it, it's this big bulb. It tastes like celery, but more delicate. It's great shaved raw. In New Orleans, they mix it with mayonnaise with capers, and it's called celery remoulade.
Mm-hmm.
What I like to do is boil it with Yukon Gold potatoes from the farmer's market, and then mash it and do just a little bit of the cooking liquid instead of lots of cream and butter, so it's lighter. And it has this sort of elusive celery root and potato flavor. It's really yummy. It's more about the vegetable and less about cups and cups of butter and cream that go into it.
Sounds great. And then for dessert, there'll probably be something with pumpkin, I would think.
Yeah, I actually currently am developing a recipe for a magazine, and I'm working on a silken tofu and pumpkin pudding with ginger snap crumbs.
Hmm.
Instead of the pie, I don't do dairy so well, so I don't eat a whole lot of cream, but I like crave creamy things. So I love silken tofu because you can mix it with other ingredients, vanilla, pumpkin, cinnamon, and you get this creamy dessert that won't give you a gut ache.
And you have such passion for all of this, Ivy. How did your cooking style evolve? Because you mentioned international and global flavor. Have you traveled a lot to develop a lot of these things? Or
I have, yeah. I went a year abroad when I was in college to Italy, outside of Florence, Italy, and I found myself a job there by just continually showing up at the kitchen. I wouldn't go away, so they finally hired me. And I've traveled to Thailand and worked in restaurants there and done a couple stages in Italy in regional parts of Italy during truffle season.
Hmm.
So I think if we could all learn one great dish from a grandmother from every culture, we would be set. Because it's those comforting, soulful, real dishes mm-hmm. that really feed us.
Which would be that could be your next book.
I would love to, yeah, follow grandmas around.
So what would be the Italian dish that comes to mind? The carbonara?
Carbonara's one. Veal tonnato is another one. It's a veal breast that's braised, and then they do a tomato or a tuna and a mayonnaise sauce with capers. It's just beautiful, and it's very elegant. It's something that you really can't make in the States just because our veal isn't raised in quite the same way
mm-hmm.
and not as humanely here as there. So,
hopefully that's changing a little bit.
Oh, hand-cut angel hair pasta with shaved truffles is a brilliant one that I learned as well.
Which one? I'm sorry?
It's hand-cut angel hair pasta that they make in the Piedmont region of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just egg yolks and flour, and so the pasta's bright orange color, and they make it just as a highlight, just as a sort of a way to spotlight how great truffles are in season, so shaved raw truffles over the top.
And we don't have any domestic truffles, or do we? Can we find
truffles? We do. Oregon actually does have truffles.
I know that there's some wild crafters in Vermont who say that they've found a few, but
Oregon, down around the Eugene area, there are people that are finding them and picking them. So it's a matter of degrees. I don't think the quality is the same as all the truffle, but I'll use them. Definitely. They have a gorgeous fragrance.
And a truffle, for our listeners, is? Can you give us a sort of quick
fungus
definition
that grows on the roots of trees
in
particular?
We all seem to think we know what it is, but what is it really?
It's a fungus that grows on the roots of trees, ash and oak trees. There are people that are working on domesticating it so that you can inoculate it into soil. They look like little pebbles. In France, they use pigs to find them. They can smell them through the soil. In Italy, they use dogs, in particular mutts. They seem to be able to find them better because they have a better sense of smell. I don't know how that works. They dust them off. When they're ripe, they make you drool a little bit. They have a buttery, kind of earthy flavor. It's not exactly a mushroom flavor. It's better than a mushroom flavor. Mm-hmm. And they do make oils out of them as well. They'll put a couple shavings of truffle in a little bottle of oil. You have to be careful with that, though, because some of the truffle oils use synthetics to make that flavor. It's not the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like that would be sort of essential in your kitchen. What are some of the other essentials in your kitchen? What is the Ivy Manning kitchen never without?
Well, especially with a mixed diet household, things that are full of umami are really important. So I always keep dried porcini mushrooms, dried shiitake mushrooms, especially the really good quality ones from Asian markets. Truffle oil, Parmesan. Always have real Parmigiano Reggiano around. And then once I'm done with grating the cheese or using the cheese and ingredients, I take the hard rind of the Parmesan and put it in soups and sauces, and it acts sort of like a bay leaf. You don't eat it, but it flavors the entire dish mm-hmm. with that subtle umami flavor. I love good olive oils and good salts. Make a big difference. Finishing salts can add a lot to a dish at the very end and just make the regular vegetables, the flavors of them shine.
And what would you say is a dish you couldn't live without? You know, what is your sort of favorite home alone meal, I always call it?
Well, not only is my husband Mr. Tofu, he won't eat meat, but he's also a little bit picky as well. So he doesn't like eggplant, and it's absolutely one of my most favorite things. So if he's out of town, usually I'm making moussaka for myself.
Well,
or something with
sense.
Eggplant.
I think that's very, very fair. And I have one other thing I wanted to ask you, because I always wonder about this when I talk to cookbook authors and recipes are developed. How does it work? Do you make something and then think about how you put it together, or do you approach it more? I mean, how do you go about creating these things?
Well, with the mixed diet method, what I'll do is get a hankering for something or be inspired by a book I read or, you know, a restaurant meal I've had, and then go home. And usually I write it out on a legal pad, how I think it might work, and then I give it a test, and I take notes while I'm cooking, and I measure everything, and I have about 8 timers in my kitchen, and I make notes while we're eating, which drives Mr. Tofu crazy, but you know, do you like it? What would make you love it? I'm always asking him questions. And then I go back to the drawing board, rewrite it, and go back to the kitchen and try it again. My neighbors are lucky people. They get a lot of food.
So you have them as tasting. And then how do you go about with the testing? I mean, do you test them all? Do you have other folks test things?
I do test them at least once if I'm not happy with it, you know, until I get it right. And then if I need any feedback, I feel it needs a little bit of tweaking, I will I have a newsletter through Google Groups, and I'll ask people, is anybody interested in trying Indonesian fried rice? I have a recipe, and, you know, great people that have taken classes from me and family members and people that are just general foodies that read my blog will respond, and then I'll give them the recipe, and they can try it out and let me know what they think. That's only if I'm, you know, really not sure about something. But normally I can do it on my own and just ask, you know, lots of dinner parties and ask friends what they think.
Mm-hmm. And then tell us a little bit about how folks can stay in touch with you. You mentioned you have a blog.
I have a blog. It's blog.ivymanning.com, or you can go to it at ivysfeast.blogspot.com. And I change weekly. The recipes change. A lot of them are mixed diet, so it'll be lasagna, one with chicken, one with, you know, without chicken, for instance. Or they're farmers market based. So I went to the farmers market, became very inspired by something, and then did the recipe, you know, made a recipe from the things I got. And I post those right away because likely other people also have a bunch of celery root, corn, carrots, the same things I had last week when I made a creamy soup. So
okay. And then the book is now available, you said, from Sasquatch Books. It's The Adaptable Feast. And so folks can be finding that all sorts of ways, right? From
Amazon, Powell's, online, and then at local booksellers as well. Barnes & Noble, I know, has picked it up and been very supportive of it because it's such a unique concept. There really isn't another book out there that tells you how to make one meal for everybody in your family without having to, you know, resort to tofu pups or corn nuggets and then or starchy side dishes for your vegetarian or vegan.
Great. Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, and this really ties into our first guest, Diane, because the Healthcare Without Harm folks are promoting a balanced menus challenge where they're asking folks to serve foods with less meat, protein, and Diane, why don't you tell us quickly about that?
Yeah, it's an initiative that Healthcare Without Harm has been promoting nationally. It's not something that we signed on to at Fletcher Allen specifically, but it's kind of in our menu development anyway. But the idea is for hospitals to reduce their meat protein purchasing by 20% in the next 12 months. And I know that lots of hospitals across the country have committed to doing that, and some of the ways that they're doing it is trying very interesting vegetarian recipe items like some of the ones we were talking about today, and then also reducing portion size. That's something that we've worked on already, but to have more moderate 3 to 4 ounce meat portions instead of what Ivy mentioned is the 8 ounce portion. So there's lots of different ways to go about it, and the outcomes are good because get a healthy dish, and also the idea is to reduce climate change through less meat production. That's the sort of global approach.
Which is really, it's terrific, and then I think what's neat, Ivy, about your book is that it really does speak to more than just what's on your plate. You know, it really does speak to a philosophy of people caring more about food, where it's from, the effect it's having on our planet. So it's wonderful to know that our food can be more adaptable and that you've found us a way to do it.
Yeah, I like to think of it as meat as a condiment.
Yeah, exactly. Meat as a condiment. It's a new way to look at it. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank
I know
you.
Everyone at your table is going to have a great meal.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your being with us, and I'll look forward to seeing you at the IACP conference in Portland.
Thanks so much.
First met you, baby, you fed me on chicken and wine. Well, it was steak and potatoes and lobster, and baby, I sure felt fine. Now all you feed me is seaweed and alfalfa sprouts and sunflower seeds, and I've got my doubts, 'cause babe, you left me here with a chicken cold.
Hi, and welcome back to the Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, on the Heritage Radio Network. And our sponsor is Hearst Ranch. And we thank them for making it possible for us to be here today. So autumn is a very exciting season in New England. There's festivals and events going on every weekend. And there's a new festival coming up this November 7th. It's a Saturday, November 7th. It will be at Shelburne Vineyards in Shelburne, Vermont. And the event's a benefit for the Chittenden County Emergency Food Shelf. It's going to start at 11 and end at 5. And I wanted to share this with you folks because Diane, our guest from today, is going to be there. She and Chef Jarmus are going to be there with their book and sampling some recipes. But it's also an event to meet the new wines. Shelburne Vineyards has been doing a great job. We have a really strong emerging wine culture here in Vermont. People thought we might not be able to grow grapes in such a cold climate, but we're doing a really impressive job. And so Shelburne Vineyard is a very generous place, generous people. Gail and Ken Albert are opening their doors to have a wonderful festival, and there'll be a lot of great folks there. Diane, you're going to be there, right?
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit more about what your plans are for that.
Well, I think we wanted to highlight a food or two that pairs nicely with some of the wines, and so we're going to be serving a roasted butternut squash soup. And some local bread, maybe some homemade crackers, and I think it will pair nicely with one of the wines that they'll be highlighting that day.
Terrific. And I think most people will be trying to do that. The Vermont butter and cheese folks will be there. They'll have their bon bouche and some of their butter. Plowgate Creamery is going to be there, and Shelburne Farms, Jasper Hill, Eden Ice Cider. Some of you folks who saw the last issue of Edible Green Mountains could have read all about Eden Ice Cider. Eleanor and Albert Legere, the first people in the United States to be making iced cider, which is actually not what you may think. It is not frozen apples the way we think of iced wine. It's actually frozen cider, and it turns into this wonderful, wonderful fermented drink. And there'll be some chocolate and Fat Toad Farm with their great caramel, wood-fired pizzas, all kinds of things. So it's a wonderful way to bring the community together, and I just wanted to make sure I share that with any listeners within driving distance. It'd be a great day to think about coming to visit us here in Vermont, and it's a wonderful way to get exposed to some terrific foods and to get some great gifts. A lot of the folks will be able to sell their products, and you'll be signing books and being able to sell things so that people get a jump on the holiday season. But we also find here in Vermont, as things get a little chillier and we can't get out and ski yet, we need a reason to get together, and so it'll create that for us too. So I think that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to the Edible Community Show. You can find me at Deborah at ediblegreenmountains.com. And I want to thank my guests, Diane Imrie and Ivy Manning, for joining me today. And I hope you'll tune in and listen to us again in a few weeks and every Monday